Action, as you know, is the umbrella, you might say, for those very, very popular programs such as the Peace Corps. I say popular because I remember when the Peace Corps began and I was a college professor, and how all of my students were incredibly interested in service in the Peace Corps. Now I am about at the age where I might join another one of Mary's programs, the Retired Senior Volunteer Program, the RSVP. She is also the Deputy Director of the Volunteers in Service to America, which is VISTA. So you can see all these fantastic programs with about 244,000 volunteers. Mary King is directly responsible for all these magnificent people. I would like, without any more taking of the valuable time of Mary King, I would like to introduce her to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I had a very strong feeling of deja vu walking here this morning, reminded me of Mexico City and the World Conference on Women. And I'm so happy that we finally got around to doing something about that here in the United States after the women of 150 countries, roughly, convened in Mexico City. Well, I think that you've done a good job in giving a very fast overview of the programs. I think one is very rarely asked to stand up and speak about how you got where you were and what you do. And it's an unusual opportunity that I've never had before to stand up in front of a group of people and say, well, this is who I am, and here, in response to what the people who set up the series have asked me to do, here's how I got here, and this is what it's all about. Peace Corps volunteers now number about 6,000 around the world in 65 countries. And they are very, very deeply and intimately involved with women for a variety of reasons. One, obviously, half of the people that these 6,000 volunteers work with are women. But in most of the countries in which Peace Corps volunteers work, women are responsible for the major proportion of agricultural production. They not only are responsible for food preparation, as in most of the world, but they are also responsible for food production. They are the agricultural workers. And in many of the parts of the world where we work, women spend half of their lives gathering firewood to burn for cooking fuel and for warmth for their families. They are the only healthcare treatment that is available for most of the people with whom we work. There are now 4 billion people in the world, at least half of whom live in desperate and absolute poverty. One quarter of those 4 billion people live in poverty that has been defined as subhuman. The conditions in which those 1 billion people live are the conditions that are barely sufficient to sustain human life. And that's where you'll find Peace Corps volunteers, in the countries where those 2 billion people are. I frequently get asked, is Peace Corps alive? Does it exist at all? And the answer is very much indeed. It is very much alive and very highly regarded around the world. The situation is similar, although not as desperate, in VISTA. Women in the United States can be bowed down by similar servitude to their husbands and children, although often the conditions are not as extreme, and frequently we have a framework of legal rights that does not exist in other countries. And in our older Americans programs, RSVP, Retired Senior Volunteer Program, the Foster Grandparents Program, and the Senior Companions Program, again, women are vitally important as the the recipients of the action of the volunteers, but they're also critically important as participants. In all of these programs, women make up a very vital proportion of the volunteers. It's about 40% in Peace Corps, and then as the ages go up in the programs, the numbers increase, the proportion of women increases. This microphone is reverberating. Is that unpleasant for you? Does it? Okay. Fine. I could spend all day telling you about the programs. There's certain things that I want to focus on, but first I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself, since that's what the sponsors asked us to do. My father is a minister and my mother is a nurse. They set a pattern for me of lifelong service. Immediately after I graduated from college, I went south to work in the civil rights movement in Georgia and Mississippi. I was one of the first whites to go to work for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was then the most activist arm of the civil rights movement. I was assistant director of communications. Julian Bond and I handled the National Press Corps, but we were also responsible for protecting the physical safety of civil rights workers to the fullest extent possible. And we did that largely by utilizing the news media. When I was involved in the South, one of the things that struck me very dramatically was the fact that it was women who were the backbone in many ways of the civil rights movement. The leadership out front may have been male, those leading the demonstrations, but it was the women who went door to door, canvassing communities. It was frequently the women who were the backbone of the organizing efforts to stimulate a community to be willing to take the risks that were involved in confronting the established order. And I think that I learned something very important then that has remained with me ever since. In 1964, along with Casey Hayden, I wrote a manifesto on women in the civil rights movement. Basically, what we said was that although women were crucially important to the movement in communities and in the civil rights organizations, they were not necessarily involved out front in the leadership and in policy making. And we distributed that memo to 40 women leaders and organizers in the peace and civil rights movement. And the following year, in 1965, a group of women at the Students for Democratic Society, SDS convention in Champaign, Urbana, walked out on the national SDS convention in what later was recognized to be the first women's caucus. So the learnings that we found in the early days of the civil rights movement as far as the crucial role of women in communities and in organizing, I think have directly contributed to some of the momentum that is now sustaining the women's movement across the United States. After I left the civil rights movement, I went to work for OEO, and I spent 5 years developing community-based health programs across the country in both rural and urban areas. These were programs that delivered a total package of services, everything from mental health to radiology to dentistry to the most fundamental preventive health care and family services. And the advantage of the programs was that they served families under one roof, so that someone who was poor didn't have to take a bus across town to reach well baby care and another bus to get in line for a clinic for eye care. And after working for OEO in the period as the Nixon administration began to come to, I'm not sure what the term is, to full flower or to its peak, I decided to leave the government in 1972 as I watched many of the programs that we had worked so hard to build being destroyed literally by the administration. And I formed my own management consulting firm in Washington with a small office in Atlanta. And we continued to work with the same clients that I had worked with when I was with OEO. The same communities, health services, community-based health services. And we branched out into criminal justice and began working with several state prison systems. That's how I got involved with women offenders. I backed into it. I suddenly found myself in Georgia working with a group of volunteers who went on a monthly basis from Emory University Medical School down to the women's detention, I should say women's prison, in Milledgeville. And as a result, I became deeply involved in prison reform in addition to the work that we were doing in community health services. When I formed my own management firm is when I first learned how desperate the situation was for women who tried to go into business for themselves. Right from the business of putting together the initial capital to going to banks, to dealing with federal agencies, to seeking contracts from state, local, and federal government. And so I worked with a number of other women in Washington to form a National Association of Women Business Owners. And we met with governors of the Federal Reserve System. We testified on Capitol Hill. We met with the administrators of a number of federal agencies that are involved in supporting or that have something to do with women who are in business. And that organization now is flourishing with chapters in several cities across the United States. And we've in effect formed our own old girl network of women who own businesses, referring business to each other, giving business to each other, tipping each other off about opportunities. It was an important breakthrough because it's been for so long such a male-only province. I think that another problem that we feel happy that we were able to deal with was the implementation of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which, as you know, after it was passed, suddenly lagged in its implementation. And we tried to apply the muscle of women business owners to that because the Federal Reserve System tried to exempt women business owners from the provisions of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. So we moved quickly on that and scotched that, got women business owners included in that. During the same period, I served as a member of the International Women's Year Commission, Committee on Women and Employment, which put together many of the portions of the plan of action that you've been working with here for the last few days, the one on statistics, women in employment, full employment, women in business, and a number of the other packages. That grew out of my participation in Mexico City in the World Conference on Women. During this same time, approximately, I met my husband, Peter Bourne, and I mention him because he figures very, very loudly in the next stage of my life. And I can't answer the question that was put to us in this series, how did you get where you are, without bringing him into the picture right now. He was on the faculty of the Emory Medical School in Atlanta, Georgia, and was serving as mental health director for one of the community-based health programs that I was responsible for. Well, he was a very desperately underpaid psychiatrist, and so I raised his salary twice and then married him a couple of years later. In 1972, following the Democratic Convention in Miami, he very, very strongly urged Governor Carter to run for the presidency. And he put together a memorandum saying, "Governor Carter, I think you ought to run for the presidency, and here's why." And he set out the reasons that he believed were compelling for Jimmy Carter to run. And then in 1973, Peter, along with Landon Butler and Hamilton Jordan and Jerry Rafshoon, put together the initial planning for the presidential campaign. And in 1973, he moved from Atlanta to Washington, partly to help establish a beachhead for Jimmy Carter, and partly, he says, because of me, which is where I was. But at any rate, in 1973, we began directing the Jimmy Carter presidential campaign in the mid-Atlantic states out of Washington, even though the national headquarters stayed in Atlanta. We directed the campaign throughout the Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C. area. Once the campaign got heavily underway, I was national director of the Committee of 51.3%, which was named for the proportion of women in our population. And I think that we put together one of the most effective political organizations for women that's ever operated at that level, at the level of a presidential campaign. We had directors in every state, and they were responsible for infusing not only the concerns and the issues of women, but also for making sure that the strategy and the policy being made in the campaign was favorable to women and urged and spurred their participation. I can't stand up here and say it was easy. It wasn't. We have a very, very long way to go in elective politics, particularly at that level. But I think that we were successful in laying the groundwork, and I think that from here on, all presidential campaigns in the future will view the participation of women in a quite considerably more strategic and tactical way than was true in the past. After the nomination was underway, we put that effort together and worked both out of Atlanta and out of the States. And I think that the results are partially shown in the consequentiality of the appointment of women in the administration. When President Carter asks what I think about the women in the administration, I have to say that the numbers are not enough. But I think that as far as the importance and the consequence of the work that the women appointees are doing, nobody can say that women are in window dressing positions or in ceremonial positions. And I think that that's partly attributable to the groundwork that we laid during the campaign. The other job that I had in the campaign was in setting up and directing the Health Policy Task Force. And we pulled together the country's leading health authorities, particularly those who were oriented to people and communities, I might add. And we developed the framework for the national health care policies of the administration right now. After the election and prior to the inauguration, I put together lists of women and met individually with each of the cabinet officers. I personally went to the cabinet officers and lobbied with them with the lists of women who were particularly well suited for high-level Schedule C appointments in their agencies. I found the cabinet officers almost uniformly extremely responsive, very willing and eager for that information. And in particular, I tried to identify women who had been buried beneath their potential in government. Because mid-level women in government are enormously talented, and they're sprinkled throughout the federal agencies where they have been capped off and where they can't move any higher. So I made a special effort to search them out, in addition, of course, to the women who were qualified across the country. And when President Carter then was inaugurated, he asked me if I would go to action and serve there. I think partly because of a special spirit that that agency represents. It is not the typical federal agency responsible for data collection or regulation or financing systems or any of the normal things that the federal government usually does. It's an agency that stands for the participation of people in grappling with their own problems and other people's problems. It's an agency that has a rather special and unique mission and a very unusual opportunity to tackle some of the most desperate problems at home and abroad. I guess you've all heard that overworked line about behind every great man there's a good woman. Well, I very often feel that behind this good woman there's a great man, because Sam Brown, who's the director of the agency, has absolutely been a joy to work with. I think that I have rarely had the opportunity to work with a man who is so honestly unthreatened by serious delegation of authority to a woman, and who is absolutely able to view me as a total team member in every sense. And he has, in fact, delegated very significant authority and will often asked me to handle some of the heaviest policy and political strategy questions that come up. He has no problems with doing that at all. We operate as a team in all of the policy areas in the agency, but that there are three areas that I handle particularly that that we have worked out as sort of special areas. One is all health programming policy for the agency, Peace Corps, VISTA, foster grandparents, senior companions, RSVP, and the other programs. All of the health programming policy is done out of my office. My executive assistant is sitting over in the corner there, Dorothy Mann, and I ripped her off from the Public Health Service in San Francisco. She has 17 years of government service, is an ideal example of what I mean when I say that there are women in the mid-level of government who have been capped off and who are being held below their potential. And so Dot did the ultimate in setting aside her house in Sausalito and coming to work for us to help us with our health programming policy. So we handle that for all of the agency in a special way. Another area that I handle uniquely is the whole business of actions relationships with the private voluntary sector. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a minute. And the third area that Sam has delegated to me as my particular responsibility is the planning and negotiation of all entry into new countries for the Peace Corps. Now, I think that this is important because if there was any area in which a man could be expected to be nervous and uptight about delegating authority, I think it's an area in which a woman would be dealing with heads of state. And I think that Sam might very, very easily have said, well, I have to handle this one because these heads of state and these ministers and so on are not going to want to deal with a woman. And instead, he didn't say that at all. He said, I think that you are the best suited to handle the negotiations, the diplomacy, the delicacy, the strategy, the tactics, and so on of putting together entry of the Peace Corps into new countries. And so I will be on my way to Bangladesh in just another week to handle the negotiation of the Peace Corps there. And I'm putting together the package for Peace Corps re-entry into Tanzania, and I'm working now on... It's a very important country. I'm working now on four other countries where we hope in fairly short order to be. Back to the business of the ties with the private voluntary sector. This is an area of enormous potential. Sam asked me if I would take particular responsibility for that, and so we have been putting together for the last several months a series of plans for developing a realistic working relationship. It's not an easy area because non-governmental groups draw a great deal of their strength precisely from the fact that they are non-governmental. Governmental groups, on the other hand, are very much limited in what they can do. And if there's one thing that I can sense, in fact, the president called last week to say that he wanted to step up activities in the whole business of spurring Americans to volunteering and getting private citizens involved in problems on a non-mandated, non-conscripted basis. And I told him that I really felt that there was a sense in the country right now that government can only do so much, and that we have to realize that there are very severe limits to what all of us can expect from government. Many of the systems that are governmental are very, very limited in their ability to involve human beings as human beings. There is a lack of caring and an absence of a human touch in so much of what government does. And I think that it's unrealistic to think that our agency or that the federal government can ever overcome that. I think what we have to realize is that there are very serious strengths and weaknesses to the federal government, and then we need to begin to put together some very realistic strategies for how private citizens working with the federal government and the federal government working with private groups can begin to meet some of our needs as a nation, but can also infuse some new caring into areas that are so desperately lacking in that spirit. Now, we have decided to put together an Office of Voluntary Citizen Participation. We're going to put some money behind it, seed money, small mini grants, technical assistance, and we're also going to be doing that overseas as well. There's a small international component, and we're going to begin tightening the relationships between the Peace Corps and the private voluntary organizations overseas. In fact, I've just returned from the Dominican Republic, where I spoke with the Partners for the Americas, which is a private group, a non-governmental group, that does very, very similar work to the Peace Corps. And we're trying to find out new ways of developing a partnership across those lines between a non-governmental group and Peace Corps. We hope to do that overseas and at home. I don't want to overpromise. I don't want to say that we can do what we can't do. But we are at least beginning to take a look at where our strengths are and beginning to seek ways of developing very solid working relationships with private organizations. Another area that I have taken particular responsibility for in our agency has to do with global problems of desertification. This is an atrocious word that the United Nations developed. It really stands for the biological degradation of land. It stands for the fact that desert is encroaching now at the rate of about 40 miles a year, and that throughout the world, there are a number of marginal areas where arid lands are no longer habitable for people. A lot of the destruction of those marginal lands is due to human use of those lands. And we feel very, very strongly, I in particular, that this is a problem that cannot be won so much by technology as by working with people. I think that if we're going to lick the problems of the desert on a worldwide basis, we're going to have to do it at the water holes where the women draw water. We're going to have to do it among the young boys as they graze their flocks. We're going to have to do it among the women who literally spend half of their lives gathering firewood. I think it is something that the remote sensing devices and the technology of the space agencies, although that may be an important piece of it, that's a minor piece. And so we have moved very aggressively since we've been appointed by the President to take some leadership in this area in speaking for the importance of orienting all programs to people and the importance of using volunteers. Once again, there is only so much that expert technicians can do. And so I have participated in meetings in Ottawa and in Nairobi and in Paris where I've argued that as the world puts together its global strategies for deploying resources against the desert, particularly in the Sahel, where $10 billion will be going over the next 10 years, that we must, from the beginning, program the utilization of people who are willing to live and work at the village level. The experts are expensive. They want to live in the capital cities. They come and they go. They usually bring families. They like to hang around with other agronomists and horticulturalists and so on. The problems of desertification have to be dealt with among the small groups of nomadic people and the small village settlements in the marginal areas. And I'm not saying that only Peace Corps volunteers can do that. I'm saying that volunteers are crucial because they do not act out of a careerist impulse or out of a professional or a technician's motivation. They act out of a different set of motivations. We're very proud of some of the changes that we've brought about in our agency that pertain to women in the employment of the agency, too. When Sam and I came into office, there were 65 Peace Corps country directors roughly around the world. Thank you. One of them was a woman. And we have Peace Corps volunteers who are men and women all over the world, and yet the history of women as staff members overseas in the Peace Corps has been absolutely appalling. We set about to correct that immediately and now have 8 Peace Corps country directors who are women, and they're doing a spectacular job. In fact, one thing that I want to do while I'm here and have you as a captive audience is pass the word that we're looking for women who have flexibility, a lot of motivation, a lot of savvy with human beings and people, who have overseas experience and good language ability. We want more women as Peace Corps country directors. And if you can help us find them, it would be great, because they're not on all of the, they're not plugged into the networks and the systems from which Peace Corps country directors in the past have been drawn. Within our agency itself, I think that we've done some fairly exciting things. In addition to myself, our new Peace Corps director is Carolyn Payton, who has been director of counseling services at Howard University. She's a psychotherapist, a professor, a person who has 5 years of experience in the Peace Corps in the past. Our director of VISTA is a woman, Marge Tabankin. Our director of the Older Americans Volunteer Programs is a woman, Helen Kelly.